What's up, everybody? Welcome back to the Student Loan Planner Podcast. Today's Friday, Financially Free Friday podcast episode. I have a problem saying that every single time we get start recording. So many Fs. I'm joined today by Scotty, one of our student loan consultants and financial planners on the team. Thanks for coming and joining with me.
Hi, Megan. Thank you for having me. Such a pleasure to be on the podcast. I haven't been on the podcast in quite a while since I was on with Lauren like last year. Maybe even longer than that ago. So yeah, it's been a minute.
Yeah, and you were itching for it. I know you were. You love this stuff. So today we are going to be chatting about the student loan borrower's financial checklist, or maybe a way to think about it is kind of the hierarchy order of where to put savings if we've got some extra savings. Our last episode was about the financial planning pyramid to get our ducks in a row to build this healthy foundation. This episode is going to chat more about how do you prioritize different goals, or what do we need to focus on first before the next thing? And this was fun because we put this idea out there to our whole team. So all of the financial advisors on the team, we've got a team of CFP professionals, CSLP professionals, so certified student loan professionals, certified financial planners, CFAs, right? Travis is a CFA.
Charter financial analyst, if you guys are trying to follow along with the
the alphabet soup. So like all these designations where we've learned so much about personal finance and how to really craft a financial plan. And you'll sometimes find yourself as a person like asking maybe a financial professional or like looking something up on Google, and you'll get multiple different answers. And just because they're different answers doesn't mean they're wrong. It just means that a lot of financial planning is very custom to the person that somebody's working with and custom to somebody's goals. And also like the economy can change things, like the different factors in somebody's financial plan can really, change how we're looking at the order of operations with somebody. So that's why it could be pretty frustrating. So it was hilarious dropping this, hey, what do you think about this checklist? You know, as far as what we need to be doing in our finances, we dropped that into our Slack channel. Oh, and the debate started, didn't it, Scotty?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it was a big debate because it depends. It's like the personal part of personal finance. You know, right. Your situation is going to be different than my situation or Megan's situation, or if we're in a high interest rate environment or if we're in a low interest rate environment. And also like a lot of this has to do with how much risk you have in your personal situation. If you have a very, very stable job, then your checklist might look a little bit different than someone that's got a really highly volatile job. So the sort of 12 steps that we came up with, and it was sort of by accident that it happened to be 12 steps, but people seem to like 12 steps. Many lives have been improved by 12 steps. So we went with that. They're going to vary a little bit and some of them overlap, but I think you got 15 financial planners in a room and we sort of generally agreed on the direction. And nobody said any of these things should not be on the list. And people, you know, just because we're nerds, argue, well, should this one be above this one or below this one? But I think if you're doing like the majority of these things, you're doing really well. So that was sort of the spirit of the assignment, at least.
Yeah. And I know a lot of people really like checklists too, like checking things off, feeling like they're organized. And sometimes it could feel really hard to be organized with your finances because it's not like a physical thing, right? We can't see it necessarily. You know, there are ways we could pull our picture together and see it in like planning software, but sometimes it's easy to just get a simple list played out so we could kind of go down the line. So let's jump in and start chatting about our financial checklist. Like what should we be focusing on first and how do we continue to kind of gradually go down the list of importance and build off of last week's episode, build a healthy foundation, but take into account like all the things that we need to take into account. So number one on the list.
Do you want to do odds? You do odds and I'll do evens.
That sounds good. So you go ahead.
Okay.
I'm odds.
One is odd. Yeah, one is odd. Yes, Megan is definitely odd. Definitely odd.
Oh,
she might look pretty normal, kids. She might look pretty normal, but nobody that does this stuff for fun is not odd. Okay, go for it.
So number one, emergency fund of 1 month of expenses. Emergency funds. We've talked a lot about this in the last episode about how it's a boring part of the plan, but it's an essential part of the plan. It's an essential part of the foundation of your finances. And 1 month of expenses, I think, is really important because that just means that this month, if something goes awry, you've at least got money to pay your rent when that comes due coming up. This is kind of a good first step. And what I would do here is just take a look at your necessary expenses. So start with your fixed expenses, then maybe take a look at maybe a conservative, let's say a good month of variable expenses. Like you're not way overspending in like groceries or eating out or anything, but like a pretty necessity-based variable expense number. Get that amount in savings, put it in high yield savings, and you're going to feel a little better at night, especially if, you know, a big bill comes and maybe your next paycheck isn't for the next couple of weeks or something. You've got a little bit of a buffer in your checking.
Yeah. So we'll get this question from folks that are at sort of the beginning of their financial journey and have a lot of high yield debt a lot of time, right? And I was like, I have like high interest credit card debt. How can I be saving, getting nothing on this money when I have a 20% credit card payment? And the way to think about this starting emergency fund, this is not going to be the end all of your emergency fund, but just get something so that when that next unexpected expense pops up, that you don't have to put it on the credit card, that you can take care of it out of cash flow. So you don't dig yourself. This is like, stop the bleeding. The first thing is like, stop the bleeding. And the 1 month of expenses, whether this is like something, $2,000, $5,000, whatever that's like is for you, is going to prevent you from digging deeper in that hole by putting something on your credit card, right? It's not like we can live off of this for 6 months if we lost our job. We're going to get to that further down the list.
It's a Band-Aid, really quick Band-Aid.
Yeah, there's a lot of problems that you can solve with like $2,000 to $10,000, whatever that number is for you. Right. You can put tires on your car for a couple thousand bucks if you really, really needed to. You could fix a water heater in your house if it blew up, if it really, really needed to. Right. Whatever those things are for you.
Yeah. And this one was pretty undebated. Like, I think the only thing that was in our Slack channel that someone said about number one, emergency fund having 1 month of reserve, was that it could be done in conjunction with number two. So that might be a good segue into what we think number two should be.
So for number two, we want to get any free money that we can get, right? So by free money, we mean like the match into our workplace retirement account. So if you have a 403B, if you're a nonprofit worker, if you have a 401K for most people that work in the private sector, anybody that's giving you a match on your contribution, that's 100% return. And we definitely don't want to pass up that money.
We talk about that quite a bit. Match is not the same thing as the max. Max is 23,000. We're going to come down to that later on in the list, but that gets us, you know, protected for the immediate and getting free money, pretty much a benefit on the table from your employer to help your future self. And then we get to number three, which is pay off high interest debt, which we could technically do all three of these things at the same time. Heck, we could do a lot of these things at the same time if we've got the right cash flow plan in place. But paying off high interest debt, that's really high on the list because it can be a wealth killer. So talking about wealth killers in America, like credit card debt is very expensive. Typically seeing 20 to 30% on those cards. And we've talked about misconceptions about credit cards in prior episodes. So we know that we should not have credit card debt or higher interest debt. And there's some rules of thumb on like, what is high interest, right? I think you have a good saying, Scotty.
Yeah. So I think anything above 5%, I think if it's below 5% debt, then under five, let it ride is kind of what I like to say. So 5%, we're getting 5% in high yield savings accounts right now, right? The annualized return of the S&P 500, depending on who you look at, is between 8 and 11%. So if we're debt that's higher than that, lower than that, we're probably better off investing that money if it's not drastically higher. So the way to think about like a debt payment is as if it is an investment. It's an investment that is equal to whatever interest rate that you're paying, right? And so if somebody came up to me and said, hey, Scotty, I've got an investment that's going to give me 26.9% guaranteed. Would I take that? 100%. Every day of the week, we're taking that 26.9%, which is it's not exactly like this. Travis will probably argue about like, well, simple interest versus compound interest, but reasonable people can just say like, okay, it's approximately the interest rate is equal to the return you're getting 100% of the time by paying off debt.
So take the net difference, you know, that can help you. Like, we have a lot of folks that'll ask like, you know, I want to throw a ton of money towards my mortgage, but they've got like a personal loan or a car loan that's like 8, 9, 10%. And it's like, I know the mortgage is the bigger debt, and maybe it's what in your mind will help your net worth as much as possible. But let's focus on the interest rates to save ourselves on the interest cost. Be smart about paying off higher interest debt. That, I think, is a good number three. Now, again, all of these things can be debated. This is a healthy debate. And let me see if there were anybody on the team that said anything. So number three, I think, was definitely chatted about as being like, needs to be up there. You know, paying off high interest debt needs to be high on the list. And I think originally when you and Jake, one of our other planners on the team, put this together, Jake was from our last episode, I think you had what we have now as number four, as number three previously, which number four is starting to contribute to a brokerage account. And I think that was debated quite a bit in our chat about actually high interest debt should be first. And again, three and four could be done at the same time, depending on the interest rate, or we could prioritize putting extra towards, investing if the interest rate isn't actually that high. But that was pretty interesting to see, like, folks kind of duke it out between those items. But yeah, let's talk about number four.
Yeah. So there's kind of like two camps of people. If you're a student loan borrower, chances are you're a highly educated person and that your lifetime earning potential is going to be pretty damn good, better than the people that didn't go to college. Not a super controversial thing to say. So if your lifetime earning potential is really high, I want my clients to start thinking of themselves as wealthy people. And what are some of the habits that wealthy people do? Even if it is just some nominal amount of money, $5, $10, $20 a week, that you're getting the muscle memory, sort of those synapses firing, that this is something wealthy people do. They invest beyond their workplace retirement accounts into a brokerage account. So you're actually invested in the economy. You're helping grow this big economy that we're all benefiting from. If that is something that like motivates you to get a raise, to change jobs, to do something else, like to start thinking like a wealthy person, I think that is where that brokerage account contribution comes in much earlier than most other people would put it on the list. And it's just some nominal amount, just to get yourself thinking that you're building something, paying yourself, and around the same time as you're paying other people by paying off credit card debt, for instance.
Yeah. And I think this is high up on the list too, for maybe two other reasons, especially for our student loan borrower listeners. So a lot of our folks are planning on going towards loan forgiveness with their income-driven plan. So they know if it's not public service loan forgiveness, there could be some kind of taxable consequence for what gets forgiven later. And so part of our planning, when we do a student loan consult and we build their plan, is we're planning on saving and investing for this potential tax bomb, because we call it a tax bomb, because it's going to be probably pretty big. And we need to have the cash right then and there when we're filing taxes that year of forgiveness. So contributing to a brokerage account can be an essential, I would call it a bill in the mix, because technically it's going towards your student loan plan. So that's another way to think about it, is we do probably need to be saving and preparing for that early so we don't have to save as much later. So that puts it really high up on the hierarchy list. And then another way to think about this too, going a little bit of a different direction, is some of the folks that we work with are either independent contractors or starting their own practice, and they don't have access to a employer plan. And so they're really starting from the get-go on their own. They have to kind of create their own benefits package. And starting to invest in a brokerage account is somewhat of a way to start saving for retirement, but it's a little more liquid, which gives us a little more flexibility. Because if we went and opened like an IRA, a Roth IRA or SEP IRA, or even a solo 401k or something, it's locked away in retirement. And if we're a business owner or creating something and growing into this role into this business person, we might need a little bit of flexibility super early on. And so putting that into a brokerage account is still doing what we need to be doing, like putting money towards our future, but it's accessible just in case.
Just in case. Yeah.
Those are a couple other reasons why, like, I feel like that should be kind of high up on the list as far as the financial priorities.
Yeah, for sure. And we can have probably a whole nother podcast about whether or not we think the tax bomb is going to be there or not.
Yeah.
I always tell clients that, like, I would rather you be upset with me because we have to figure out how to spend $50,000 or $60,000 or $100,000 that we've saved for the tax bomb.
For sure.
than be upset with me because we didn't have it and we needed it.
Yeah. Or didn't save enough. Yeah.
Or didn't save enough. Yeah. For sure.
Exactly. So just to recap, emergency savings is number one, getting up to 1 month of reserve. Two is getting our employer match if we have one. Three is paying off high interest debt. Four is setting up automatic contributions into a brokerage account to build some healthy habits. Think like a wealthy person, maybe start saving as a business owner and maybe start saving for that tax bomb, depending on what bucket you fall in there. Number five is getting our emergency fund to 3 to 6 months of expenses. So coming back, talking about emergency funds again, right? Our foundational layer for what we need to do to build our financial plan. 3 to 6 months is a really good rule of thumb for a couple of reasons. Kind of like you were saying earlier, Scotty, like you can take care of a lot with 3 months of reserves, right? If you think about it, if you add up like your expenses times three, you could take care of a lot of emergencies all at once, thankfully. You could also take care of if you're out of work for a period of time. And then another way you could think about it is you can take care of your expenses if you're out of work due to being sick or injured. So disability insurance, a lot of employers offer this. You can also purchase independent coverage. We're going to talk about disability insurance actually next. I'm stealing your thunder, Scotty. We typically have some kind of waiting period before disability insurance kicks in to start paying you your paycheck if you're out of work. Commonly, it's 90 days. So we kind of need something to hold us over for that period of time if we're not able to work in the same capacity and our employer is not paying us the same. We've run out of PTO, we've run out of, you know, the short-term options that they have at work. So that is another rationale behind the 3 to 6 months. We just want to throw that in a high-yield savings account. It should be boring because we want it to be there no matter what.
Yeah, I like to tell people this is not an investment. The emergency fund is not an investment. It's an insurance policy that you're writing for yourself, right? And that 3 to 6 month range depends on a handful of things. If I am dual income household, okay, maybe we can be closer to that 3 month range. If I'm like a nurse and a firefighter, those are very stable jobs. They're recession resistant jobs. Maybe they're closer to 3 months. If I am a solo entrepreneur, acupuncturist, chiropractor, veterinarian, like I am the sole breadwinner for my family and I'm my own business, I want to be closer to that 6 months, right? But really this is like, how much money do you need to be able to sleep well at night knowing that if something happened, you could take care of it, write the check and not go into credit card debt, right? Because at this point, we're like past credit card debt. And remember how awful that felt. Remember how like out of control of your life you felt when you had a credit card debt. Looking at some 5 to 6 digit number in most people's high yield savings account, which I think is probably the appropriate place to put this emergency fund, is very comforting.
You could conquer the world. You could do anything. Yeah. You could leave your job tomorrow if you hate your boss and find something else later and you don't have to jump on the next thing.
Right. The 3 to 6 month emergency fund gives you the ability to say no.
Yes.
To say no to stuff that, you know, say you lose your job, to say no to a job that has a commute, to say no to a job that is going to be not in your long-term trajectory, which is super powerful.
And that's also why it's at the foundational layer of that planning pyramid. Yep. And another thing that was in that foundational layer was insurance. So next up, I stole Scotty's thunder already, but disability insurance.
Yeah, So disability insurance, usually some people have some short-term and long-term disability insurance through their group policies at work. A lot of our clients are physicians. More common for physicians and dentists to have own occupation disability insurance. Probably worth doing. I think we have a whole episode on disability insurance, don't we, Megan?
Well, yeah.
So own occupation disability insurance is just a special kind that says, hey, if I can't be an orthopedic surgeon, then you got to pay me like an orthopedic surgeon.
Versus like a Walmart greeter.
Walmart, right? Right. Which honestly, I know some orthopedic surgeons that would probably love to be Walmart greeters. It'd be a very happy life for them.
They'd be even happier though if they got the same paycheck while they were Walmart greeting.
Right, right. But just like Megan said, you know, there is a cost to that. And you have to have the elimination period of that 90 days, kind of like stacked in cash. So you got to be able to get to the term where your disability insurance is going to kick in. So it's not a replacement for an emergency fund, but it will last us longer, right? So a long-term disability insurance, if you had like some major medical accident and you couldn't do X, Y, or Z thing that you used to be able to do, disability insurance is going to be one of those things that can prevent a plan exploding. Becoming disabled, that can sink a financial plan. So that's a lot of these things that are on this list are like, what are the things that can like sink a financial plan? And let's protect against those things as best we can. Can't protect against everything, but the things that we can control, let's try and control.
Yeah. These are the things like disability insurance. Like if we don't have, they're catastrophic when we don't have it, but we need it. And they're also the things that we hope we don't ever have to use. Like hopefully disability insurance is a waste of money because that means you're healthy. You're not in need for that to be kicking in. Disability insurance premiums, typically what I see is between 1% to 3% of somebody's gross income. That's typically the cost of a disability policy, a good one. 3% would be for somebody who doesn't have any employer coverage. So you're really covering the cost of your disability insurance on your own. I highly, 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 highly recommend this, especially if you're a single person and or you're a business owner, because you are your own income stream. What happens if you're not able to earn that income anymore? And that might sound like, oh, that'll never happen to me. But us being in this financial planning space, we've seen it all. We've seen very healthy people have to go out on claim and thank goodness they had something in place, because otherwise they would have unwound all the planning that we had done, you know, taken money from retirement accounts or had to go live with mom. And we don't want to do that. We don't want to move back to, you know, wherever she lives. So it really protects you. And I think it is really catastrophic not to have if you were to need it. So that I think takes us to number seven. So number seven has to do with health as well. Number seven would be maxing your health savings account, if applicable. Some people can contribute to these, some people can't. HSA could also be, we could also debate like if FSA makes sense, if we have access to that, but we don't have access to HSA.
There's some people that do and some people that don't. Depends on whether you have something called a high deductible plan. And oftentimes if you're buying insurance on one of the marketplaces, it'll say high deductible plan, HSA eligible plans, or your employer-based plan during that open enrollment time will have one that's a high deductible plan that would then make you eligible for a health savings account. SIM loves health savings accounts. It's one of the sneakiest retirement accounts out there. It's triple tax advantage. So the money you get a tax deduction for this year, it grows without being sort of penalized by taxes while it's invested. And then if it's used for medical expenses, qualifying medical expenses, then that money can be pulled out of the HSA tax-free as well.
There's no time limit.
Exactly. So say you incur a $10,000 medical expense in 2024, or like let's say it's $7,000 and you paid your deductible with your health savings account, but you had the cash flow to do it because you had done 1 through 6 on this list already. So you just paid that out of cash flow. Well, you hang on to that receipt. And then in the future, if you ever needed to access those funds, you can pull them out whenever you need to, right? So the health savings account for people that are going for financial independence or people that are going to retire early can be a really great bridge from when I stop working at 50 to when I can access my retirement accounts at 59 and a half. Probably not going to be the difference between financial independence, yes or no, but it can be an excellent bridge used in conjunction with some of these other tools to get you to the point where the bulk of most people's savings are in those workplace accounts.
Oh, yeah. Right,
so how do we get you there?
Yep. So yeah, number seven, max health savings account. Now, if you don't have access to a health savings account, you could potentially have access to an FSA, which is a flex savings account, which is similar. It's a smaller amount that you can contribute. There's also FSA dependent care, which is for like contributing to reimburse yourself kind of for costs of dependent care. So those can be really useful as well. The downside to an FSA for healthcare is it does have a time limit, where HSA is pretty free, willy-nilly, you could use it whenever. FSA, nope. We have this year to use it, and if we don't use it, we lose it. So that's a pretty stinky benefit if we over-contributed. There's some sneaky things that you can pay for with FSAs, though, so definitely make sure you chat with your provider or your whatever custodian you have for your FSA company, ask about like what's eligible to be used for. Like, could you spend it on a chiropractor? Could you spend it on like massages or sunscreen? Like certain things like that could be paid for. So make sure to use it because you're not going to be able to roll it.
Do you recall it used to be able to pay gym memberships with FSAs?
Yeah.
I don't know if that's still the case.
I think it really depends. Yeah. So definitely get like a full list of what you're able to use. Keep that in front of you over the course of the year and make sure to use it. Because a lot of plans, they have one or two kind of backup options if you have extra money left in there. One is that you can roll over a very small amount. It's not a lot.
$500.
Yeah. So you can maybe roll over a little bit, but if you put $2,000 in it, you're still out $1,500.
And then what do? You buy $1,500 worth of sunscreen on December 29th right. or something. You know what I mean? It's like you start stockpiling Q-tips. Not a good look.
Exactly.
not a good look to be in Walgreens on New Year's Eve trying to buy $1,500 worth of sunscreen. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Pretty funny. And then some plans, it depends. They can offer one of these two options. Some plans allow you like a 3-month or 2-month grace period where you could go over the year, like over the calendar year and still use the funds, but you got to do it by the grace period end. So those are some cautionary things about FSAs. Still good options, especially if you do typically spend on some of these things. But it, you know, it's a kind of an emergency savings account for health savings, but better because it's more tax advantageous and it can be used for so many other things as far as like it being invested. You could, you know, save receipts, pay cash for certain things and use the funds for that future that you were talking about, Scotty, to kind of bridge the gap. But that brings us to number eight. Let's jump into number eight with you.
Number eight, max fund your 401k, 403b, or 457. And I always have to like fight for the 457 to get thrown in on this list. It's my personal favorite of all these accounts.
Why is that, Scotty?
So for the folks that are doing the good work and working for not-for-profits or government agencies, oftentimes you'll have something called a 457B account, which is a deferred comp. And the magic of the 457B, unlike the 403B or the 401K, is that if you were to separate service, like you leave that job, then you can access those funds without the 10% withdrawal penalty. So say you're a cop or a fireman or somebody that's going to, a lot of public safety folks, they're going to retire in their early 50s and wouldn't have access to like a 403B until they're 59 and a half, are able to access the 457 funds earlier. Or, you know, say you worked at you were an environmental scientist and you left that cushy job to go join a financial planning startup. If you needed to, you could access the funds that you put into your 457 without that 10% withdrawal period. Penalty. Now it's still a taxable event if they're not Roth. So it's still a taxable event, but it's money there that's more accessible than the money that's in the 403B or the 401K. Which is like the bulk of most people's savings, right? So if you're a D2 employee, there's not a lot of ways for you to reduce your taxable income. There's not a lot of ways to save on taxes this year. Also set yourself up for a comfortable retirement and also lower your student loan payment outside of contributing to these accounts, right? And we talked a little bit earlier about getting the match. So my feeble man brain doesn't understand percentages very well. So I always talk about like real numbers, the max. So $23,000 a year, that's the max that you can put into these buckets. The 457 is a separate limit. So you can put $23,000 into the 457, $23,000 into a 403B. Oftentimes you're not going to have a 403B and a 401K, but it's not unheard of, you know, but those limits are aggregated. The 457 is its own limit above and beyond what you put into those other accounts.
In the financial planning space, the 457 is kind of like the stepchild. It's like it is part of these other fours that we're talking about, 401k, 403b, but it has different rules. It's a little different. You can contribute to that plus your other account. So it's pretty cool. We run into this when we're working with public servants, like you were saying. Fun story. Scotty, you came from the Water District, right, of California? You like jumped ship from your government job to come
ship.
Work with us.
Yeah. So, and a lot of that was because I had done, not to toot my own horn, but because I had done a lot of the stuff on this list. And when an opportunity popped up, I was able to say, well, I can go and do this thing that I probably wouldn't have been able to do had I not done a handful of these things on the list. And I'm not saying it was easy, but I was able to do it living in one of the most expensive areas in the country on a single income that wasn't like a crazy tech worker, multiple hundreds of thousands of dollars a year income living in Silicon Valley, just by doing these fundamental things, by like making sure that I was paying off high interest credit card debt. And granted, it took for me to get to that point from when I was like able to say yes to things like this, like working with Megan, was a multi-year journey. This financial checklist is not going to be like a six-month thing for a lot of folks. For some people, it will be. You know, if you have a really low cost of living or if you have a really high income, this could be a much faster operation. But it's possible. It's possible. You know what I mean? So these things are possible for people that are single income, for people that live in high cost of living areas, for people that are not making crazy amounts of money, you know? Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah, with the right plan, I think, and with the right, like, idea of your goals, like being grounded in your goals. And Scotty, honestly, you're like one of the most impressive people to me. I'm not just saying that for a fun, quick story, and then we'll get back to our list. Scotty was on our newsletter, the Student Loan Planner newsletter back in the day, that which started like back when Travis started,
like
this
very
whole
early
thing.
Like 2016, 2017.
Yeah, I was gonna say like it was early. And he was following, you know, the newsletters on an ongoing basis. He would interact with Travis every so often on some of his emails. And he wanted to join the team. You know, when we were hiring, I think the first time they did a bigger hire was maybe 2018, 19, something like that.
Something.
So Travis put out like just a message in the newsletter that said, hey, we're looking for consultants. And Scotty had dove headfirst into the student loan world, learning a lot about student loans and all this craziness, because you had your own loans. That's not a secret. I think you talked about that, and you were going towards PSLF. So this was something that like interested you specifically because it was your life. And then Travis said, hey, we're only really hiring people who have, you know, this designation, the CFP designation, Certified Financial Planner. And then later it became the CSLP, Certified Student Loan Professional designation. And you were like, okay. And you went back and you literally got the CFP designation, which for people who don't know, and I know we're talking about Alphabet Soup right now, but in the financial planning space, that is not a small feat. That is like the doctorate in the financial planning space. That means education, you've got basically a whole course load of finance-related college courses that you have to go back and take. You have to pass a test to move on to the next education course. You have to then pass a case study where you present a full financial plan to an instructor. Then you can sit for the CFP exam. And it is a very difficult exam because, as we know, financial planning is not as easy as 1 + 2 = 3. It's what happens if 1 might be 1 and 2 could be 2 today, but 2.5 tomorrow. What is the answer? Like it's a more complicated exam because it's, you have to be a critical thinker. You have to be thinking about what's best for the client in that specific scenario. So again, very complicated, but Scotty went and did that. He went and did that and came back and was like, hey, I got my CFP. I think Travis probably fell out of his chair. He's like,
how do you
what?
Like me now? Yeah. How do you like me now, Travis?
So we pulled him in. We were like, we've got to have this guy. He went and got his CSLP as well. And so now he's on our team. We cannot let him leave, guys. We cannot let him leave. So if you're his client, please be nice to him.
No, my client's the best. Yeah. Thank you. That's very sweet of you.
But yeah, I think it's cool that you lived this, you lived these steps, you know, so you are speaking from like your own truth too here. So yeah, maxing 401k fund, 403b, 457, that's step 8. Let's jump to step 9.
With the last little caveat that this happens sometime for people, you actually have to invest it, right? So
oh, yeah.
Just because you just because you've contributed to the account doesn't mean you've that money is invested. It could just be sitting there in a holding account, in a cash account, within that bucket. So make sure that it's invested. And this is not investing advice. This is just some people having a friendly conversation on the internet. So, but invest it in a reasonable way.
Get it invested. Exactly. Now, number 9. Now, this is debatable for sure. It depends on your family situation and your risk tolerance. But we put on this list number 9 as getting life insurance. And there's some rules of thumb around how much life insurance you should have. Life insurance is more about protecting the people you love and leaving behind maybe a legacy if you want to, but taking care of like your affairs when you're not here to be able to do so. And so you could think about life insurance in a couple different ways. Think about it as paying off debts that won't be forgiven upon death. Thankfully, federal student loans are dischargeable upon death.
Yeah, I always tell people if you have another good reason to die, then go ahead and do it, but don't die just to get rid of your student loans.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. We don't recommend that route, but it is the fastest way to pay off student loans. 100%, just kidding. But yeah, death benefit could be an amount that just covers the debts that will be lingering around for family members, like maybe a loan that you co-signed on with somebody, your mortgage with your spouse, a car note that you're paying for your brother, something like that. So think about it that way, or think about it from an income perspective. A lot of families these days, a lot of households these days rely on each other's incomes, both spouses' incomes, or you might be the breadwinner of the household, which even more so, we need to be thinking about replacing that income if you're no longer going to be here, or the family you leave behind is going to have to drastically change their lifestyle and like uproot their lives when they're already going through a really difficult time. So, you know, there is a rule of thumb of 10 times your gross income. That's kind of a quick, easy back of the napkin math equation to get just a starting point, and then maybe compare it to the things that we're talking about, like covering a certain number of years of income for you, covering the debts that you have in the mix that you don't want to pass to anybody else. And maybe one other way to think about it too is things that you wished you would have been able to do if you were alive. So if you wished you would have been able to fully fund your kids' education fund, but you're not going to be here to do it, that's something that you can factor into the equation in the death benefit to make sure that school is taken care of, you know, mom or dad is taken care of, the kids are taken care of. So anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, sure. So a lot of people have some health insurance through their work. Those plans are usually like 1 to 3x life insurance through the work. Yeah, thank you. Those plans are usually like 1 to 3x your salary for the most part. Probably not going to be enough to pay off a mortgage in a lot of parts of this country. You know what I mean? Also, if you leave the job, you leave that life insurance behind. So if you're going to be supplementing life insurance, we generally recommend you do it on your own outside of your workplace plan. And like Megan said, that number can be, if it's for like wage replacement for a spouse that gets hit by a bus or abducted by aliens or something, then we're looking for like 10x. We're looking for 10x. So I always joke, we want enough so that your spouse doesn't have to marry the 90-year-old billionaire, but not so much that they marry the 19-year-old pool cleaner. You know,
that's good.
Somewhere in the middle is probably the right about. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's not a fun thing to think about by any means, but it is actually one of the, I would say, easier insurances to get, because it is kind of a get it and forget it for a while. You might need to revisit it every so often if your family situation changes. But like, for example, I've looked at life insurance in my life twice. I don't have children yet, but I do anticipate children down the line. So I did kind of pre-plan for factoring that in. Like, the idea is that we'll have kids later, but I want to make sure that, you know, if I'm not here, my spouse is taken care of, my dogs are taken care of, my kids, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
So I went ahead and got the coverage also because the life insurance cost it's dependent on two things. It's dependent on your health and your age. Your health typically doesn't get better over time, right? And hopefully you maintain. And maybe if you're changing lifestyles, situations, maybe it gets a little better. But you're not going to get younger. Biologically, we can't get younger. So the cost of insurance goes up when you get older. So it gives me a lot of peace of mind to know that I have just a policy that is not tied to work. It's mine. I just have to pay the premium to make sure it's there if I need it. Hopefully I never do, right? Hopefully it's a waste of money.
Yeah, it's usually pretty affordable for most people. Most of our clients are kind of, you know, 30-year term policy kind of folks. And 99.9% of the time, term life insurance is the right answer for most people. If you have somebody that's trying to sell you something fancier than that, then kind of maybe be a little suspect, maybe dig a little deeper. But for most of the people, the term policy is the right answer.
Easy peasy. Debatable, right, though? Because you know, if you're young and if you've got dependents already, like, this might be high on the priority list for you because your risk tolerance is just, you're not able to sleep at night without knowing that you've got coverage here. So this completely could be earlier up on the list, especially if it's very affordable. If we could fit it into our cash flow, I think that's great. So this is not an ironclad 9 on the list, but it definitely is something we have to address. So we put it on here somewhere after some of the really important things in the beginning.
Yeah. If you have kids, if you have a spouse that depends on you, if you have a mortgage, you kind of need some life insurance probably. If that doesn't sound like you, then maybe it's higher up on the list.
All right. Let's get to number 10 and number a quick 10. Recap. Let me recap where we're at. So number one, let's see how fast I can do this. There is a game that does this, by the way. I can't remember the name, but it's where like you have to go in a line and you have to repeat all the things that everybody else before you said. And if you miss...
Cognitive functioning test.
Yes, it's really fun, actually. But number one, we need a 1 month emergency savings fund. Number two, we need to hit the employer match. Match, T-C-H, not max. Number three, we need to pay off higher interest debt. Number four, start contributing to a brokerage account, get an automatic contribution going. Number five, emergency fund, 3 to 6 months of expenses. Number six, disability insurance. Number seven, max out an HSA or look into an FSA. Number eight, max out your 401k, your 403b, your 457, whatever employer account that you have, TSP if you're another government employee. Number nine, life insurance, which brings us to number 10.
Number 10, do the max contribution to a Roth IRA. And if you can't contribute to a Roth IRA, either because you're filing separately as a married person or you make too much money, then consider doing a backdoor Roth IRA. So for most of our folks that we're advising on student loan stuff, a Roth IRA is generally not the first thing that we recommend. It's generally not the first place we save because what's the whole game with student loans? We got to lower your AGI, right? A Roth contribution does not lower your AGI in the year that you make that contribution. There's still a lot of really good reasons to do a Roth. That money is a little bit more flexible. You can get the contributions back out if you ever put them in. Once your heirs the bucket after you do number nine, that money is easier for your estate to deal with than if the money was in a traditional IRA. But once you've already kind of taken care of a lot of those extra things, why not do a Roth, right? It's kind of how I feel about it. Yeah.
It's another bucket that's a tax preferred bucket, tax free, I guess you could say later on, where, you know, you contribute to it now, you pay the taxes on the money now, and then you never pay taxes on the principal that you put in or the growth in it ever again, which is very attractive from a financial planning perspective, because when we're planning for options. And we're planning for long-term, along with the short-term things, but we're planning for long-term, and having options helps you pivot your plan depending on whatever happens in the future, whatever's going on in the economy, the tax code, whatever's happening. We've got that flexibility with the different accounts that we can distribute money from. So it's a pretty cool bucket.
We talk about wanting to have like asset diversification, and we also want to have some tax diversification. And that's what a Roth allows us to do. Right, is to have some tax diversification. There is copious amounts of TikTok influencers that are like, we'll say Roth versus traditional, right? And make it seem like it is this like end all be all of your financial life if you're not doing a Roth or if you're not doing a backdoor Roth. There's a reason that it's number 10 on this list. Like, it's important, it's worth talking about, but I think of it as like a tailwind. You're not going to not retire because you did a Roth versus a traditional IRA. But if you're like optimizing for all the optimization, then a Roth should definitely be part of the conversation at some point.
Yeah, I think it's a great bucket. It's a great supplement to the additional retirement savings that you're already maxing out. It's one other bucket you can run to save more. Next up on the list, that brings us to saving more. This increased contribution to brokerage accounts. So this is number 11. So we've got a lot of our basics, a lot of our foundation built. We're starting the wealth accumulation phase on the financial planning pyramid. Next up is increasing contributions to a brokerage account to be one, ready for the tax bomb, and two, be ready for maybe earlier retirement, and three, to have additional funds, because who's ever upset about having extra money? No one.
Totally. The brokerage account is like the most flexible place that we can save and invest because we've already paid taxes on that money. It's got no special rules attached to it. We can do whatever we want with it. It's our money, right? If you want to retire before you're 65, chances are you're not going to be able to do it without investing outside of your workplace retirement accounts, right? Chances are you're not going to be able to do it by just putting that $23,000 a year into your 403b. So you've got to get aggressive.
Plus a 7 for Roth, maybe like 30 max, right?
right. Yeah. Talking about like the habits that wealthy people have, this is one of those things. You're going to have a brokerage account. I think that like having the brokerage account just like makes you pay attention to what's going on in the world a little bit more. I want to get my clients to a place where like, we're not worrying about money, but we think about money without worrying about it. And like having money that's actually like on the table in the economy, in the investments is like makes you pay attention to the world in a different way than if you're just like not invested.
You're not part of it. Yeah.
Not part of the game, you know? Mm-hmm. So participate in the world, people. That's what investing in the stock market does. Yeah.
Yeah. And there's a lot of cool ways too that we can make this investing very tax efficient to help save taxes on things later on down the road too. We use tax loss harvesting in our investment strategies with clients that can help like just reduce capital gains in the future on practice sales or even like an appreciated home sale. So we do some strategic things with investing here in this brokerage account that affect other areas of our financial plan. Yeah, it's just a really flexible account. And I think number 11 kind of can tie into number 12. So let's talk about the last thing on the list here.
Yeah. So once we've taken care of all of those other things, if that stuff kind of can vary depending on your situation, we start thinking about like the bigger goals. And that might be early retirement for some people. It might be planning for a house purchase. It might be planning for that like around the world trip, you know, for a sabbatical. Right. So goal-based planning kind of comes after these things are sort of taken care of or on their way to be taken care of. And the sort of the timetable of those goals kind of dictates the appropriate amount of risk to take to accomplish them.
To save for them. Yeah. Cause you can be saving in like the high yield savings account for these short-term goals, right? If they're within the next couple of years, I would say like put that money in the high yield savings account. Then we have like midterm goals, which might be like buying a house in 5 to 10 years or leaving your job in 5 to 10 years. And then there's the long term, which long term would be like way later on, like a huge house renovation or like going and retiring, taking the whole family to Europe, something like that. So that we can maybe afford to invest and have a little more, I hate using the word risky, but just being a little more exposed to the market.
Yeah, it's important to distinguish between like risk and volatility. Risk is not being able to actually accomplish your goal. It's not having enough money when you're 75, so you're not eating cans of dented tuna sitting under a bridge, right? volatility is knowing the money is going to be there or having a higher degree of certainty of the money being there when we're going to need it. So if something's way off in the future, 10 plus years, we can afford to ride the wave of the volatility in the economy. But if we're making a house purchase in the next like 2 to 5 years, we want to know it's there on next Wednesday so that we can make that down payment if we needed to and not worry about like the price of Apple stock, you know, that actually happened to a friend of mine. Had a financial advisor put money from a fruit company in Cupertino in that they were planning on using for a down payment on their house into the market, and it wasn't there when they needed it, right? So that money should be in cash if it's a short-term goal.
Yeah. And it's not like they lost it all. It was just it declined just in value.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. It wasn't the amount that was they needed at the time wasn't there at the
right time. Yeah.
At the right time. Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. And I think with number 12, so us putting this on the very end of the list, that's not to say that we have to do every single one of these things first, no matter what, no questions asked. Like, no, we can't plan for the house or we can't plan for expanding our family. Like, that's not the case. Again, this is a personal financial plan. So we definitely have wiggle room to be able to layer in goal planning into some of these steps or like alongside some of these steps to work towards at the same time, because we do financial planning so you can live the life that you want to live. And, you know, money is not the obstacle or it's not what's preventing you from being able to do the things that you want to do. So goal planning is definitely important and like putting what you want to accomplish, like if it's travel each year or if it's, you know, whatever the case is, like we want to build that in. We just have to do it smart. We have to do it in the right way. I think I'm trying to look back at the conversation of like what the planners were going back and forth on. And I think that was a pretty common trend. Like, yeah, 12 could be prioritized over some of these other things for sure.
Right. So like a perfect example for me, 12 goal-based planning comes higher on my list than life insurance. If I got hit by a bus tomorrow, somebody would water my plants. And that would be the sort of extent of it.
Right. People will be emotionally devastated, but not financially devastated.
Right. There's no one that's like financially reliant on me personally that I'm taking care of is more important than me saving for some of the other goals. Being able to say yes to awesome job opportunities, being able to fund a sabbatical. Those sort of things are higher on my personal list than life insurance is. Now, like the flip side of that is like my brother has a family, has a mortgage. Dude needs life insurance, right?
Yeah.
Gotta have it.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, again, personal financial planning is completely personal. And these are conversations that you would have with your financial advisor who knows your situation forwards and backwards. They know what kind of hierarchy order we should be thinking about, and you have conversations about it. It's not like in your meetings, Scotty, or in my meetings, you know, I'm not ironclad saying we have to do it this way. It's, hey, this is what I would recommend based on what I know about your situation and my expertise. What do you think? And talking through like pros and cons and like really crafting the plan to fit what we need to accomplish, right? That's the whole point of financial planning and having somebody on your side to help you through these decisions and to help you organize your priorities and also keep you accountable. Because it's pretty easy to let some of these things slip and feel like, that's not as serious as I thought it was. You know, of course it is. That's why financial planners have financial planners. Like, behavior is a big part of this conversation too. And the accountability to what we said we wanted to do and what we need to be doing, like the accountability is part of the equation.
Yeah. It's like financial planning is where like accountability meets math meets human behavior. You know,
right.
It's like, that's what accountability and that's what financial planning is. It's like figuring out how to like align our finances with our values. You know,
yes.
Like there's a math answer. And this list that we just went through, these 12 steps, is largely the math answer. Right. If you want it to be like absolutely optimized for optimization's sake, this is probably what most people would do. But there's also like the personal part of that, that is like the best plan is the one that you will actually do. So if the best mathematical plan, you're never going to do it, then I will take the plan you'll actually do over the best math plan every day of the week.
Right. Well, this was so fun. We didn't, you know, knock out, drag out, no fights on this conversation, right? Because it's always like we can be flexible with these steps. But I think this is a good checklist for folks to have in the back of their minds when they're thinking about their own finances and thinking about what's next, what still needs to be taken care of before they can kind of move on to that next step. And it was a good chat. Thank you so much for your wisdom,
you're
Scotty,
welcome.
And for joining
you.
Me. Yeah.
Always happy to be here. So if you're a financial client, financial planning client, S&P Wealth, and you want help with any one of these one things, send your planner a message. Set up a 30-minute focus session. If you want to figure out where to set these priorities for yourself and you're not a financial planning client, look for a CFP in your area. Reach out to somebody at S&P Wealth. There's folks that can help you with this sort of thing. There's also lots of free resources out there that can get you pointing in the right direction, like this podcast, like all the calculators that we have, like all the free
blog
articles that we have. So there's a lot of resources out there. It's not just like professional help. You can do a lot of this stuff on your own. It's like going to the gym, though. Could you get better results if you're working with a trainer? Probably.
Yeah.
But something is better than nothing. So don't let like perfect be the enemy of good. So just get started. Do something.
Yeah. And debate with us. You know, if you're listening to this, debate with us about what you think should be on this list or what you think we got wrong. That's okay. We're happy to debate it. It's a healthy conversation. Or, you know, let us know what next step you're working towards in your own journey. Like, this is an exciting thing, too, to look back and see how far you've come. If you're looking at your financial situation now, like, you know, 5 years ago probably looked a lot different and you didn't have a lot of these things checked off. Now you probably do. But thanks for hanging out with us on a Friday. And I hope you guys listening have a really awesome weekend, and we will catch you on the next one.
Thanks, Megan.
What if you could get fiduciary financial planning specific to your profession that's student loan aware that could change your life for a price much better than you ever dreamed possible? If that sounds good to you, go to slpwealth.com/pod for a free, no obligation, 15-minute intro call with one of our own fiduciary financial planners to see if we could be a good fit for you. This podcast is for informational, educational, and entertainment purposes only and should not be considered individualized investment advice. If a specific investment is mentioned, do not consider it a recommendation to buy or sell the investment. Seek first advice from a financial professional before implementing any strategies discussed. All investments involve risk, and past performance does not guarantee future results. Yay, compliance.